Welcome to the flyfisher.co.za podcasts. Right, I'm sitting with Ed Herbst in Rhodes at the moment, looking out over the town. It's quite a stunning morning. We were a little bit scared yesterday that there was a cold front coming, and welcome to the podcast, Ed.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's get straight into it. You've been fishing a hell of a long time. When and how did you get into it?
A hell of a long time is it's almost a lifetime, I would say, because for some reason, and it's very much lost in the distant past, sometime in the early 50s, my mom, she was a widow, bought me a fishing rod and took me by bus to the Durban Harbour, where I caught a rock cod, which we ate. And I think that sort of fired the enthusiasm. And then I was a very enthusiastic reader as a child, so I always used to go into the central news agency, the local bookshop, and I came across a magazine called Rod and Gun. And it had an article about the young Theodore Roosevelt, or one of the American presidents, and how as a child they had fished for big catfish in the Mississippi, and it had pictures of these youngsters with their bent rods and all that. And I was just absolutely fascinated, and I badgered my mother to buy me this magazine. It was called Rod and Gun, and I think that sparked a lifelong interest, first in hunting and fishing, and then eventually I dropped the hunting, I think as many people do, because they couldn't reconcile themselves with the killing aspect of hunting. Fishing, particularly fly fishing, has the element of the stalk and all that sort of almost primeval excitement, but without the need to kill the quarry. Then I graduated to fishing in rivers for barbel and yellowfish with worm and paste and all that sort of thing. And then was eventually invited to stay on a farm with a friend in Natal where they had bass dams, and my mother bought me a spinning rod. It was a solid glass rod, and I was just dumbfounded by the technology that with a flick of the wrist I could throw this little spoon halfway into the dam. And I'd always been interested in fly fishing, but somehow it just seemed a step too far. It was just too mystifying, and I didn't know where to start. And I lived in Maritzburg for a long, long time, where Tom Sutcliffe and other people were fly fishing, and regrettably missed all those years because I never got involved. And then luckily I was transferred to Cape Town by the South African Broadcasting Corporation, for who I was then working, and stayed with a friend, and he had got a bursary from the Department of Water Affairs, and they received a complimentary copy of Piscator, which was the magazine of the Cape Piscatorial Society. And I phoned the Cape Piscatorial Society, joined, and that was the start of a 30-year intense passion with fly fishing. I'm now a vice president of the Cape Piscatorial Society. I edit their magazine, and most of my fly fishing has been in the Cape.
Sure, so it's quite an interesting past, but it flows nicely into where you are now. Where have you fished around the country if you grew up in Natal?
Regrettably, I've never fly fished in Natal. It's one of my great regrets, because I'm interested in a sliver of fly fishing, and that is small stream fly fishing with ultralight rods and light tippets and small, relatively small flies. So regrettably, I haven't fished in Natal. I have a regular correspondence with Peter Brigg, whose new book, Call of the Stream, I think is probably the most beautiful fly fishing book that I've ever seen in the English language, and I think I've seen most. So regrettably, most of my fishing has been confined to Natal. Then the southernmost tip of the Drakensberg, here in Rhodes and Maclear. And then once a year I go up to Mkhubas Kloof in the Transvaal near Polokwane, where the Heinesburg Trout Association has some lovely streams. They have an annual AGM and get together and a fly fishing festival, and I'm often invited up there as a guest. So far my small stream fly fishing has been confined to the Western Cape, the streams around Cape Town, roads in Maclear, and then, as I say, in the northern Transvaal, in the mountains, the Mkhubeskloof Mountains.
Have you done anything internationally?
No, regrettably. as a journalist in South Africa, you don't have the money to travel, so unfortunately not.
You talk of small streams. What kind of setup do you fish with?
I like most men, I'm interested in boys' toys, constantly looking at the new technology. I think I owe a great deal of debt of gratitude, as I think do all fly fishermen, trout fishermen, to the late Howard Steer, who was the rod designer for Orvis, and Lee Perkins, the then CEO, challenged him to bring out a two-weight rod, which everybody thought was a bit far out and certainly not likely to succeed. Steer rose to that challenge. He produced first the two-weight, then the world's first one-weight, and then he accepted another challenge from Lee Perkins, which was to produce a one-ounce rod, which is a 6.5-foot two-weight. And I had all of those rods. I was fortunate to be friendly with the importers of Orvis in South Africa, the fly fishermen in Pietermaritzburg, Tom Sutcliffe, Roger Bart, people like that. So through them, I had access to these ultra light rods and the Orvis CFO2. And then when Dean Impson came back about 10 years ago from the fly fishing expo, and told me about the Sage Nordweight, I couldn't contain my excitement, and I sent off, to their great chagrin, a 120-page fax. I mean, they still talk about it today, shaking their heads. This nutter in South Africa who couldn't wait to get his hands on the first Sage Nordweight, and that duly arrived. Real technology never really progressed for a long time beyond the Orvis CFO2.
Yeah.
But the rods kept getting lighter and lighter. First the nought weight, then the double nought, and now the triple nought, which I now have. On the reel side, I'm very happy to say that we've finally gone one step further than the Orvis CFO2. The original Orvis CFO2, simple, light, wonderful little reel, weighed in at 2.5 ounces. The new Sage Click comes in at a third bigger and a quarter of an ounce lighter. I'm selling all my other reels. That, I think, is the ultimate small stream reel at the moment. I don't like, and I'm convinced that the shiny finishes which are put on fly rods today are significantly detrimental to success. One of my friends, Tom Sutcliffe, who sees fish very easily, was fishing behind a fish which was visibly feeding hard and very committed to feeding, and he raised his rod, and as he raised his rod, the fish disappeared, and he came to a fairly profound conclusion, profound in terms of its consequences, I think, and what he decided was that light had actually bounced off the fly rod into the water ahead of the fish and come back into its eyes. He said that was the only thing that he could comprehend which would have spooked that fish. And down in the Western Cape, I've collaborated with a wonderful craftsman called Stephen Boshoff. He's a town planner, but an exquisite rod builder. And we've built what we call the one-off one-ounce or the small stream special. And we just worked towards the ultimate small stream rod. It had to be a matte finish rod, and it had to have as low a mass as possible. And through David Levine, who's the of Stealth Fly Rod and Reel in Johannesburg, who's the Scott agent, he brought in for us a couple of Scott one-weight blanks. It was a 7'6" blank and an 8-foot blank. And Steve Boshoff then started working on reel handles, guide placement, and all that sort of thing, which we felt would become the ultimate small stream rod. And everything is done. Fly keepers we don't have. We don't have butt caps. The back of the rod is just plain, and you can actually see the blank. There's no butt cap. We're just doing everything we can to reduce weight. We use ultralight black matte finish packed bay guides, and we, more often than not, we just spray the rod with a khaki hobby paint, and then use markers to make it even more camouflaged with streaks of brown and green and that sort, and black and that sort of thing, to break up the image. And I would say I'm now getting my rods made by Derek Smith. So got a reversed half wells grip, And it's an uplocking reel seat with a very thin little ring which holds the back reel foot. The front reel foot is fits into a recessed portion in the rod handle, and then on the top of the rod we have a shelf of cork that runs all the way back to the reel. And why we do that is because your hand naturally tends to slip back, and then it slips back onto that cold wood and all that sort of thing. And this reel seat with this little piece of cork helps to position your hand and keep it comfortable. And it's obviously a lot lighter than the wooden reel seats which are used on commercial reels today. It's not a new idea. I've seen that Marc Petitjean, the Swiss CDC guy, uses rods with that shelf of cork at the back. And I would say that, and I use silk lines, and I would say that outfit together, half a double taper silk line, ultralight custom-built Sage triple knot rod built by Derek Smith, and the new Sage Click reel, I would say that outfit on its own, in total, weighs less, for example, than the Able small stream reel. So here you have a rod, reel, and line combination, which is actually lighter than some of the reels on the market. And there's quite an important principle here, is that in the Western Cape we often fish in great heat, fish up to temperatures up to 28, 30 degrees Celsius. We fish in canyons, kloofs as we call them in South Africa, which contain that heat. It's a very rapid fire cadence of casting. You're wading, and you might be casting very short drifts, popping the fly just behind the rocks wherever you think there might be a fish. Very short drifts, a foot or more. So you could be casting as often as three times in a minute. And if you're doing that all day and you want to stay reasonably fresh, then the lighter your rod and reel, the better. And of course, the Sage Triple Knot is a quite phenomenal rod in terms of accuracy. It can handle small bead heads, so that's my combination for small streams.
Well, that brings us beautifully into flies. Little dry flies, little nymphs. What kind of flies are you tying, and what kind of flies are you fishing? Where are you putting them?
I think one of my benefits that I've had for South African fly fishing is that I'm a bit of a fly fishing sponge. First with magazines and books, I pull diverse threads from all over the world together, and then of course subsequently with the internet and Google and all the information, the massive information which you can pull together there. And I think one of the first little breakthroughs, if you like, was when I read about Mike Weaver, who's one of these best-known small stream fly fishing experts and authors in England, wrote about a small sunken beetle, which he said was very effective. And that really appealed to me. So I started tying small, slightly weighted beetles, and I fished them with a strike indicator like a nymph, and that seemed to have some resonance with South African fly fishing, and fishing the sunken beetle, I think was one of my first little success stories in South African fly fishing. Because prior to that, of course, originally first wet flies, salmon flies in the early 1900s, which then went on to traditional wet flies, and then in the 60s nymph fishing became popular. But I think this was the first time that anybody had written about the idea of a sunken terrestrial. The idea of vulnerability in flies is something that appeals to me greatly. And fortunately or unfortunately, because it's had quite a significant impact on the direction that fly fishing has taken on the Western Cape small trout streams, we do not have situations of very selective trout in the Western Cape. There are no hatches of any significance. I think most the research shows that certainly on the smaller freestone streams in South Africa, most of the nymphs hatch at night, and they hatch not at the water surface but by crawling out onto rocks. So we don't have significant mayfly or caddis emergences in the Western Cape. What we do have is a spinner flight where a little mayfly, Coroterpes nigrescens, the darkening dun, comes and it lays its eggs, and they dip down and they dip their abdomens into the water and then fly against the current to pull the egg sac away, and that normally at about 10 o'clock in the morning, inspires a brief rise, but for the rest of it, you're fishing to fish which will take literally anything that comes along. And the idea of vulnerability in fly fish, in flies has always appealed to me. The building in the maximum amount of movement, creating the idea of something that is struggling to get away. And many, many years ago, a British fly fisher called Geoffrey Bucknell designed a buzzer which had a deer hair head. And at the same time, the comparadons were coming out from Cauchy and Nastasi in the United States. And I thought, well, why don't I put a Cauchy and Nastasi wing onto a curved hook and make a sort of a merger out of that? And that worked very well. And then I developed other interests, started getting interested in small hoppers, ants, and that sort of thing. And what has been very interesting to me is one of the best fly fishing books in the recent decade is Hunting Trout by Bob Wyatt, a British fly fisher. He has set on that fly that I sort of developed independently back in the 70s. In other words, a flared mayfly wing with a curved body under the surface. And the next fly that had a very significant impact on me was Hans Weilemann's CDC and Elk, and it had an impact on me for quite an interesting reason. We were fishing a tiny little tributary, and Stephen Boshoff, who's a traditionalist of note, he will not use artificial materials in his flies. We came up to a promising little run, and I always rag him because I try and more to get a rise out of him than anything else. I put I'd built this fly which was purely synthetic materials. It was a glass bead ant with rubber legs, and I said, okay, and he had a cast and nothing happened, and I said, okay, step aside for the all synthetic fly. And it was a tiny little pocket, I mean as big as your sort of dining room table, and I drifted this little ant through there half a dozen times, and I said, all right, forget about it, there's nothing there. And he said, okay, now I'm going to catch a fish. And he walked up and he threw this fly onto this little pocket which I had fished so thoroughly, and immediately a fish came out, small fish came out and hammered this fly, and it got away. And he said, but okay, I'm going to now catch another fish. Threw it up again and another fish had a go at it. And then he said, now I'm going to fish it sunken. And he spat on it and he threw it in and said, help me, another fish came out. And I said, my God, what is that fly? And he said, it's Hans Weilemann's CDC and Elk. And I was just dumbfounded. Now, I must say that because of my reading, I had read about CDC in American magazines 10 or 15 years ago, and I brought some in, and I was sitting on the whole slurt one day having lunch, and I thought, well, let me try this CDC fly. And I threw it out into a slack piece of water and just munched my sandwich, and in no time a fish came out, and it was sitting there and the wind was activating these feathers, and a fish came out and took it. And I was just dumbfounded because it was quite a distance off the main current. And I dried it and threw it out again, and it just sat there, and again a fish came and took it. But I came to the conclusion that the feathers would mat up and wet very quickly, and I never took that experiment any further. And that, I think, was a great loss. And then along came the CDC and Elk. And I just thought, well, hell, this is a great fly. Why don't we tie it, the CDC body, onto a curved sedge hook, and then we'll have a body which is further down into the water than Hans Weilemann's thing. And then I was also very impressed by Roman Moser's balloon caddis. And he fished a trawn in Austria, and his caddis was just a deer hair wing caddis, but it had a foam head. And that was based on the idea that as the caddis came out, that big head emerged. And I thought, well, why don't I combine my Hans Weilemann emerger and put a foam head on it? So that was the next step. And then the micro rubbers started appearing on the market. And so I added rubber legs and antennae. So here I had a Hans Weilemann caddis with an abdomen, a CDC abdomen that dipped into the water. It had a foam head, and I'd use a bullet head orange foam. And then it had these thin rubber legs and antennae. And that worked exceptionally well because it had so much movement. It floated like a cork. half the body was beneath the water surface, and you could see it because of this foam rubber at the head, the derivative of Roman Moses' balloon caddis. And then the next step that came along was the discovery of a material called bait cotton. And it's an, one thing I never do, and I think as fly fishers we might make a fatal mistake if we are arrogant enough to look down on other disciplines of fly fishing. I mean, if you look at the, particularly in Europe, the match fishing techniques by the people who fish competitions, I mean, the technology is just mind-boggling. And I always go into tackle shops, normal tackle shops, and browse around, and I came across this stuff called bait cotton, which is an ultra-thin, translucent lycra, and it's used for tying delicate baits onto hooks for sea fishing and that sort of thing. And I realized that here was a rubber leg material par excellence. It takes a marker. If you use brown and then black, you get a stippled effect. And soft hackles have been a major breakthrough in the Western Cape. And what sparked that was the arrival in this country of Eduardo Ferrero, the captain of the Italian and team manager of the Italian national fly fishing team in the World Championships. And he looked at our rivers and said, these are soft tackle rivers par excellence. But the problem that I have with soft tackles is that I can't see them in the water, and I have to fish them. I have to fish them with a yarn strike indicator. And I was absolutely fascinated, and I always have been held in thrall by a fly that one of the most cerebral and brilliant thinkers in fly fishing, brilliant Vincent Marinaro, called his hanging emerger. And what Marinaro wanted to do was to have a mayfly that was literally bumping its head against the ceiling, that was just beneath the surface, and was above all in a vertical position. And how he did that was to use a riffling hitch. He put a knot and then put a riffling hitch, and that actually cocked the fly into a vertical position. And it suddenly occurred to me one day that I don't need to do that complicated knot. All I have to do is use Art Lee's surgeon swivel. Now, Art Lee's surgeon swivel is just a stop knot, and it was designed for the for big variants and spiders, and the idea was that if it could spin around the tippet, it wouldn't twist the tippet so much, and you could use last tippets. And so it's just a knot at the end of the tippet, and the fly is free to slide up and down behind it and to rotate, and that avoids tippet twist. And I thought, well, if I use that knot, I will be forcing the fly into a vertical position, and I don't have to use Marinaro's complicated riffle hitch. And then it occurred to me that if I took a soft tackle and I put a little ether foam post on it, what I would have would be a soft tackle drifting vertically in the water with a little ether foam post that I could that I would make it a lot easier for me to see. And what you must keep in mind, of course, is that Gary LaFontaine, another one of the great American thinkers, was a great fan of ether foam and its fish-attracting properties. And then the final step in my little hanging emerger was, of course, to put two rubber tails at the end of it. And this has proved exceptionally effective. It's got the benefits of a soft hackle kicking and moving in the current. It's hanging vertically. Down below are those two rubber tails kicking and struggling. And the little ether foam post keeps it mired in the surface film, and you can actually see it. So that's become my almost constant fly that I use now. It works exceptionally well. Fish seem to start rising to it a lot earlier, possibly because they can see it along a lot further, and they come up very slowly and almost innocently to take this fly. And I think it combines so many different ideas: the rubber tails, the soft tackle, the post of ether foam, and the knot, the slip knot, which holds it in a vertical position. And above all, I think it has all those characteristics that I've always looked for, which is vulnerability.
Yeah, sure. That's a whole lot of information. Thank you. I think a lot of people learn something from that. When we talk about flies, Your fly tying has always been slightly on the different side. What weird and wonderful materials, other than your bait cotton, have you found and discovered?
I like the idea of easily available materials. I've always worked on the idea of triggers. It's an old idea. Many people have used that. And then to try and pack as many triggers as you can onto hooks, you need to use a very fine thread. And I've gone successively finer and finer and finer as finer threads have come onto the market. One of the materials that I just love is domestic cling film, which is used in kitchens to wrap up food and that sort of thing. If you stretch it, it gets an almost translucent appeal to it, and if you cut that up, it makes wonderful wings on sunken spinners, on ant patterns, and that sort of thing. So aside from that, I think those are the two materials that I've found which are a little out of the ordinary. I'm sure other people have used that. There's an even finer form of the bait cotton called sewing inelastic, and is used on in ruching sleeves so that the sleeves sit tightly on your wrist, and that is sold in haberdashery shops under a variety of proprietary names. The one that I use is called Goldsack, and that's a rubber that's literally as thin as cotton. So those are the two materials, and make, if you can use them for ant legs, beetle legs, all that sort of thing. Gives a wonderful amount of movement, and as I say, is quite translucent. But I like the idea of transferring, for example, or recreating a fly like the goldhead pheasant tail. If you put a little wing of cling film on the top of that, you turn it into a form of sunken spinner, and a lot of the spinners actually go underwater to lay their eggs.
True.
And I think that little piece of cling film on the top of a beadhead pheasant tail adds quite a significant trigger.
Sure. Okay, well, we try to keep these to about 30 to 35 minutes, so let's wrap it up. Let's go through the quick fire favorites, which would be favorite dry fly.
It has to be CDC, doesn't it? Under our circumstances, and my guru there is Agostino Ronchella. You can find his flies on www.pipam.org. It's an Italian site. He's brought out a wonderful book called Magi in CDC, which is being translated into English, and just the most astonishingly original, simple one feather CDC flies imaginable. Just a wonderful, wonderful breakthrough. So emphatically CDC.
Okay. Favorite nymph?
Nymphs? No. I think Fred Steinberg, who's a guide here in Rhodes, has done stomach pumpings over about 2 years, and he's found that literally 99% of the food content of the trout in the Rhodes McClear area are nymphs. So it would be a beadhead pheasant tail with rubber legs and tails.
Your favourite rod is going to be a triple knot?
Yes and no. I have also fallen under the wonderful aura of Split Cane in Cape Town. We have a wonderful rod maker, Stephen Dugmore. I think his website is freestonerods.co.za. And he's built me up another rod that's held me in thrall ever since I became interested in fly fishing. That's the Leonard Baby Catskill, the first whisper rod ever, but certainly the whisper rod of the cane era. He's built me a seven-foot triple knot split cane rod on a baby Catskill taper. So those are my two favorite rods. I don't fish the split cane all that often because it's not very useful if there's a bit of a downstream breeze, whereas the triple knot can hold its own, particularly if you get down on one knee and cast sideways into the barrier layer, the boundary layer, I should say. So certainly those two ultralight rods, both of which fish very light silk lines.
Yeah. You're a little bit well known for traveling with a small menagerie of stuff. And the next question is, favorite gadget or gizmo?
Yo. I suppose it would have to be, it has to be my J-Vice. Jay Smit, and he has a website, jayvast.com or .co.za. Is a brilliant tool maker down in Durban. He's chairman of the Durban Fly Ties Guild, and he built up a wonderful rotary vice. And I started collaborating with him on the ultimate midge vice, and he came up collaborating with fly ties around the world on a very special midge jaw. And the configuration of that vice is very, very useful to me. So it forms the basis of my fly tying, and that would be one of my favorites. And then, as Ed Engel said, a Goodbrod 10-0 thread changed my life. Unfortunately, the Goodbrod company has gone out of business, so either I've got to find a lot more Goodbrod, or I don't have to live for much longer. But I'd be very sad the day the Goodbrod 10-0 thread ran out.
Yeah. All right. Now, again, no lingering on this question, but favorite author, book, movie?
I'm a weepy, so I don't go to movies. They affect me badly. even comedies. The moment there's a bit of pathos, I start crying. So I suppose it would have to be A River Runs Through It. Favorite author has to be Ernest Schwabit, just in a league of his own, incomparable, awesome. I have all his books, and my copy of Trout is battered, threadbare, dirty, book-eared, dog-eared, underlined. Schwabit has to be the beginning and the end, as far as I'm concerned. If you read only one man's books, it has to be Schwabit. They're encyclopedic.
Yeah. All expenses paid trip anywhere in the world.
I think I'm going to give you an answer which is quite intriguing, and it comes back to my love of light tackle. And my girlfriend and I went to the Seychelles, and I'd taken a 9-weight rod and a couple of big bonefish flies just on the off chance. And the first day we were staying in a little seaside resort, and we wandered out for a swim, and I said to Jean, but there are fish in amongst the swimmers. And I saw these grey shapes, and I thought, yay, bonefish. And so I ran and got the rod and went out, and these fish were everywhere. And she got up onto a little jetty, and she said, no, they're either ignoring your fly or they're spooked. And it turned out that these were mullet, and I came back. I was just fascinated. And I came back, and I posed the question, if you could fish in knee-deep water in windless conditions for trout under a sunny sky, and there are shoals and shoals of fish, trout of about a kilo, you'd think you'd died and gone to heaven. And everybody said, yes, we would definitely have died and gone to heaven. So I said, well, that's exactly what the mullet fishing in the Seychelles is like. You could fish for those fish, and the guys are now doing that in the Western Cape. They're catching mullet on 2 weights in very clear water. So I think my all expenses paid trip would be to a place like Christmas Island or the Seychelles. I'd like to take a split cane rod. I'm thinking of the rod that Wayne Macker makes. He's a phenomenal rod maker, and his rods are exceptionally strong. He makes them down to a 4-weight. And I'd like to fish for mullet with a Wayne Macker split cane rod in the Bahamas or the Seychelles or Christmas Island. Spooky fish in wonderful conditions on a split cane rod. A bit of a tall order. I don't think I'm ever going to get there unless I become suddenly rich, but that would be my ideal.
That was a really interesting answer. Thank you so much for your time, Ed. I think everybody's going to learn something. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Lovely to be here.
Great.
They say you know life is given, but I tell you now, it's all within that river. You find yourself in the heart of heaven. Close off so long, you could swim forever. One place to rest your grace, a silver sands lead the way. The water's golden, stories told, free clouds, sapphire summer days. Fun way to spend your day, take yourself and leave right away. Drive 6 hours and walk 5 days. Hey, hey, hey.